This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. November 24th, the Chicago Police Department released the long-awaited dash cam video from the shooting death of Laquan McDonald in Chicago. Craig Futterman, clinical professor of law and director of the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Project, was instrumental in that release through his successful FOIA request. Professor Futterman and the Invisible Institute recently released the Citizens Police Data Project, which provides a powerful tool to research several years of complaints against Chicago police officers. Now, Professor Futterman talks with us about the alarming numbers on race and police misconduct in Chicago and the context for the most recent police killings of the 55-year-old mother of five, Betty Jones, and her young upstairs neighbor, 19-year-old Quintano LaGuerre. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start from something positive. The work that you are doing that engenders the questions of accountability, transparency, and the systemic reality of police abuse, particularly of a racial nature. So begin by telling us about the project you're involved in.
Sure. Until the housing projects were torn down in Chicago and entire communities were disappeared, my law students and I worked for about 7 years from the ground floor of what was called Stateway Gardens, a public housing development on Chicago's South Side. It became a second home to us, a home base from the law school where we work. Our primary work there was working with residents in public housing, documenting human rights conditions, reporting on them, working with residents to try to improve police service and accountability in their community. State Street Corridor, that's where we were working, where Stateway sat, made up at that time the largest concentration of public housing in the nation, largest concentration of poverty in the nation, about a four-mile stretch of 10 and 17-story high-rise apartments filled with thousands of our nation's poorest families. Everybody who lived there was black. For context, then, during that time, we got to know a woman by the name of Diane, a 50-year-old public school janitor, single parent who lived there. We mostly knew her just as a friendly face who always seemed to have a kind word and honestly some delicious food for her neighbors. Mm. And then we just stopped seeing her. Nowhere to be found. Turns out that over the course of about a year, a team of five tactical police officers subjected Diane to a series of repeated assaults on her person, her home, family, religion, and this group, who were widely known as the Skullcap Crew, forced her on a couple of occasions to disrobe, bare the most private parts of her body, threaten her with a loaded gun, needle-nose pliers, screwdriver, leaving her convinced they were going to rape or kill her, beat and choked her. They assaulted her with racist, sexist epithets of the worst kind, tore up her home. They threatened to plant drugs on her. They even brought a middle-aged neighbor into her home, and she had a teenage son, and they forced her teenage son to beat the older black man for their amusement, like a staged cockfight. So this is the context in which we were working. Then my students and I learned that these five officers had engaged in a years-long pattern of abusing black folk in public housing, Southside Chicago. We hear multiple firsthand reports of what they were doing, including their sadistic sexual abuse of her. What distinguished these guys more than anything else was their overt racism and the particular pleasure that they seemed to take in these acts. Most of all, they knew with absolute certainty that they could abuse black folk in public housing without fear of consequence. Nothing would happen to them. That was the context in which we got into this, because our work really started and this project was designed to be a project that would be community-based, on the ground, directed by people in the community, as opposed to a project where we, and I'm a law professor too, so in my ivory tower, where I'm just picking out, here's something I think is important, and let's go find people who could help us raise an issue. So the work that we did around transparency and accountability, and even the work that ultimately led to the release and the uncovering, the ending of the secrecy of the video of the execution of Laquan McDonald, started right there in 8 square blocks of Chicago's South Side, then we wound up bringing a civil rights lawsuit with Diane and her neighbors to not just challenge, and my students tend to ask not just questions about what occurred, but how and why it occurred. Why were five officers who worked in public housing, what were the conditions, the underlying conditions that allowed them to believe that they could abuse black people here with absolute impunity? And so as a part of our investigation, as a part of our lawsuit, we obtained about 6 years of data from the city about every single complaint that involved police brutality or other serious abuse. When we analyzed that data, we saw exactly why the Skullcap crew thought that they could operate with impunity. Our police department here, and this is not unique to Chicago, but they refused to examine patterns of abuse in black and brown communities, that the probability that the members of the Skullcap crew would be disciplined when charged with abuse, nearly zero. Fellow officers would cover for them every time when abusing black folks. And that the department's practices, because we actually also got to look at all these investigative files, hundreds of files, that the department's practices for investigating misconduct were designed to ensure that officers like them would be absolutely immune from discipline. We got to see this under what's called a court protective order, meaning a secret order that nobody else can see this but us and for the purposes of litigation. This is critically important information that was hidden from the public. Why all these things were going on in Chicago and why these things, secrecy and institutional denial, why these things are going on around urban America. That's what led to us ultimately bringing, in addition to this lawsuit where we uncover this information, but we're not allowed to share it as we're fighting for justice for Diane. But we also then bring a Freedom of Information Act case, and it's something that nobody was bringing. There was all this major media, and nobody stepped up to bring anything like this. But an independent journalist worked with us and tried to intervene in this case, and he brought a Freedom of Information Act suit to try to uncover this stuff, to establish the principle that, hey, this is critically important information that belongs to the people. It took about 5 years and a five-year fight, but we were ultimately successful in establishing that precedent first in Illinois. And the database that you just talked about, because over the next year, this happened about a year ago when we won that case. But to bring this home, we're in the process and we just built a database that tries to give everybody that resides in the community, ordinary people, researchers, scholars, journalists, policymakers, police organizers, advocates, everybody, with access to information about every single police misconduct complaint in Chicago. And if we're ultimately successful, this is what we're going to have, because nothing like this exists in the nation. We're going to have information on every single complaint in Chicago from 1967 to the present. Every complaint available to every single person. That is, to me, the core of the beginning of how we begin to address these problems. It's a fundamental redistribution of power from police to ordinary people. And to me, any conversation about solutions, much less trying to build positive relationships or trust between black and brown communities and police, has to begin with some honesty, and that's acknowledging the reality of experience of folks in some of our country's most marginalized communities. That's the work that we're trying to do.
So you begin to quantify and have this significant data, which should lead to both transparency at some point and accountability. It certainly has led to some individual litigation. The video release, for example, of Laquan McDonald, the terrifying, searing into one's soul execution of this young man. What further do you think is accomplished that can begin to strike at the institutionalized basis of police violence in Chicago and the racialized nature of police violence?
Transparency, honesty is the first step. And it's only the first step, because opening up police departments to the people, that doesn't automatically eliminate racism or sexism within them. It doesn't end the code of silence. It doesn't guarantee that we're going to have fair, thorough, or high-quality investigations into police misconduct. And it certainly doesn't put an end to patterns of police abuse. But what it does do is it creates the conditions to accomplish each and every one of those things if we all act and if we make use of this information. And I think that's where there lies real hope that this is something that can be a real transformative moment when we redistribute that fundamental power from the police to the people, that's what creates conditions for accountability. That's what creates conditions for addressing and diagnosing accurately, just like my medical friends tell me. I mean, if you don't have an accurate diagnosis, you're not going to get an accurate, you're not going to have an effective cure. And diagnosis here are issues of absence of police accountability, racism, and institutional denial. This is the very kind of information, as well as critically important. I mean, these are just data that documents the real and lived experiences of people who are at the ground. And it also means truly engaging, listening to, and the effective activism of folks at the ground, like folks in the Black Lives Matter movement, who've really begun to force broader society to reckon with those realities and challenge people to care about the lives of all Black folks.
Sharon Farley, who's head of the Independent Police Review Authority, she's the new head. The older head had been dismissed because of his incompetence and the cover-up of the death of Laquan McDonald. She called for some new procedures in that authority. Now, I know that you're also calling for a new police auditor's office. What do you think should be done with regard to review of the conduct of the police in these matters?
There's a multi-pronged piece, and it starts with honesty. It starts with, hey, when an incident of charged abuse goes down, if you want any hope of trust, you got to start with some honesty. If you lie to people, if you deny what happens, if you cover it up, no one's ever going to trust you. So it starts with, when something goes down, you got to be transparent about it. And that means tell people the truth. It means that there is something like a video, that there's no reason why, and particularly a video that occurs in a public area, there's no reason why that shouldn't be released within 24 to 48 hours. It starts with that, but then it ends with a system of accountability. And that means addressing things like the police code of silence, starting with some honesty again. You got to acknowledge that it exists in New York as well. I mean, there's a code of silence about the code of silence. What's that, a Hollywood movie? When that is one of the most inimical things to any accountability, that hurts the people and honestly hurts the police, good, honest, and ethical officers as well, by giving them a bad name when officers are allowed to abuse the most vulnerable among us with impunity. You know, there's the age-old question of who polices the police, and certainly we all do. The role and being, and for the public to play that role and to play it in a meaningful way, it means we got to be informed and we have to act. There's no one right solution, and around the country, we have different ways in which the public's involved, from in the role of monitor to civilian review to almost like an appellate court. There's no one right way. I'm a fan more of giving civilians the real power to do these investigations independent from the police, and in ways in which they are fully empowered to do and fully funded to do those investigations, so that it's not just, you know, the reality, unfortunately, is also around the nation. That includes in New York with CCRB, is that the history of these organizations have been largely ineffective. So the way in which we make them much more effective is, one, we establish them in ways and create independence. Two, we give them the resources and the power that they need to do their jobs and to do their work. Three, we ensure that they're looking at things like patterns of abuse, patterns of misconduct, not turning a blind eye to that. Four, dealing with collective bargaining agreements that stand in the way of doing effective, high-quality investigations. And then four, when you find that officers have done wrong, you don't hesitate to do what you're supposed to do. When you weed out those officers who are abusive, and you send a message to the good officers that that's not what we are about. We're not about doing this. Those, to me, are the first steps. And then, of course, there's a lot more, and it means training. It means a change of mindset among officers. It means addressing the realities of racism, both conscious and unconscious, that exists both in society and certainly on police forces, as well as police officers are a part of all of who we are. And it means taking those things on head on.
Police officer Van Dyke, yep, who will be the first police officer who's been charged in an on-duty shooting in Chicago. But he had 20 misconduct complaints which were made against him in the past 4.5 years. None led to disciplinary action against the Chicago Police Department. How do you see that reality in the context of what you are doing now so admirably, which is the accumulation of data and the release of the information that you accomplish.
Knowledge is power. So imagine if first all the people, as we do now, had access to this information. And then something that exists in Chicago, and this is not unique to Chicago, but this is around the nation. As around the nation, most urban police departments have a policy and practice where they refuse to look at patterns of complaints as a part of investigating misconduct or disciplining misconduct. And that's just indefensible. If we looked at patterns, and just as you said, so just taking Van Dyke as one example, within just a few years before him shooting and killing Laquan, 17-year-old child, he had 20 complaints, most of them for brutality, almost all of them against black folks. He had been involved in two other shootings just within a couple of years of shooting this kid. He had been not just sued once, sued twice, and not just even sued, but found guilty of brutality by a federal jury, costing the city, I think, $500,000. It shouldn't have taken 20 complaints and that pattern before we had done something about him. And so if the people had this information, that's where it's our job to act and say, city, as a matter of policy, if we can see this, certainly so can you. It's more long past time that you use this knowledge to weed out those racist officers, abusive officers among us that also give honorable officers a bad name and do so much harm to the entire community.
How might you look at Rahm Emanuel and his duty, his responsibility, or the omission, the negligence in responding to a history of police abuse in the Chicago Police Department, indeed, with a terrifying, sordid history of torture, as well as these shootings? What do you think his responsibility should be? Should part of the issue of the rectification be now to call for him to step down?
Mayor Emanuel did not create this stuff. He did not create the code of silent racism in the police department. He was not the one who was responsible for implementing a pattern and practice of police torture, which very well did exist. And we still have prisoners in Illinois who have been tortured and who are still fighting for their freedom. But upon inheriting it, it was and is his responsibility to address it. And that's an area in which, up to this point, he has fallen. And he now admits that he has fallen far short of doing what needs to be done. On the positive side, I was saying he was a part of creating an historic reparations ordinance for victims of police torture that acknowledged, and again, step one is acknowledging this history of torture in Chicago. And indeed, it is now part of our law that we are teaching it to public school students in our classrooms as a part of history. Where he's fallen short has been not just about acknowledging history, because it's one thing to say that was then, but this is now. We don't have these issues anymore. And until just a few weeks ago, he was a part of the problem of denial. He took a step in the right direction when he negotiated with us around this policy of new openness of the police department, making that policy a reality after we fought and won that litigation. He did work with us, and that was a major step in the right direction. But it's now really incumbent upon him, and it's incumbent upon all of us, so whether it be calling for, some are calling for his resignation, and others are also calling just for him to do what he's supposed to do, to hold him accountable. He has now owned these issues finally. I think that creates a contract with the people, as long as he is in office, that he is also publicly accountable for these conditions and for addressing them. We've begun to take some steps in that direction, but it's more than just crisis management. It's, to quote Mayor Emanuel to himself, who said as an aide to President Obama, never let a good crisis go to waste. But the more important part of the quote is because it creates the opportunities for leaders to do what they otherwise could not do. He has an historic opportunity, and the question is how he is going to go down, what his legacy will be. So he has a chance, and I think it's incumbent upon all of us to hold him accountable for his obligations and responsibility to address these issues, which he is responsible for.
How has he been handling, in your view, the recent police killings of Quintanio Liguerre and Biddy Jones?
Well, I'm an outsider here, and this is also just going down. And one thing that I'd say that has been a marked change from what I've ever seen, and in Chicago, these shootings occur and have occurred for the last 30 years on an average of a weekly basis. And that's something that goes back about 30 years. Something that also hasn't changed over 30 years is that 75% of the people shot by police are African American. It has been more than 50 years, or actually never when in terms of an African American, never in history am I aware of a single instance up until just now in which a Chicago police officer was criminally prosecuted for an on-duty shooting of a black man, woman, or child. So in terms of one thing that I've seen different now, and it is a marked change, was that almost immediately after the shooting, there was an admission that part of the shooting, at least, was an accident. I've never heard that kind of admission before, that they did not intend to shoot. This is the neighbor. Yeah. But since then, and still not a lot of time has passed, and this goes to my point about step one is being transparent and telling the truth throughout the process. It's keeping people informed and releasing information to the public. As long as it's not going to compromise the integrity investigation, they should be sharing a lot more, because that's how you're going to earn and that's how you're ultimately going to win any kind of a trust. As far as the incident itself, I wasn't there, but I'm an outside observer, and it seems horrible and tragic. An incident that starts with a young man emotionally disturbed with a baseball bat should not end in the taking of his life or the life of a neighbor. But there's a lot more to be learned and seen with that, and I think the responsibility is to be upfront and transparent about what's there and what happened.
How do you begin to understand the systemic roots deep in the history of our country? Are policing apparatuses that formed for control of the African-American communities, whether or not it's a conscious bias, grievous, outrageous bigotry, or so rooted in the psyche and social fabric of this country. What do you see as the roots of these prevalent abuses and taking of black life within Chicago that further need to be addressed?
Well, it starts with one word, and that's racism. The history of policing in this country was founded on slave patrol, viewing black folks as property. There's a long legacy that then has moved forward, and there is a long and sordid history of racialized policing in America that's not just a relic of the past, that continues today. So it's addressing and being honest, not just about the history, but about present-day realities of what can sometimes feel like a system of apartheid justice. Going back to public housing and also work that we're presently doing with high school students in the south and west sides of Chicago, predominantly African-American neighborhoods. And my students mostly come from relatively privileged backgrounds, University of Chicago Law School, and they're taught in their law school classrooms about the Constitution. And then they go and they spend time and see a very different reality in black and brown communities in Chicago, where this Constitution that they learn about and that has been consistent with most of their own experience in their lifetime doesn't seem to apply in places where we've worked, in places where so many folks live. That the reality of just you're young, you're black, you're on the street, you live with the ever-present reality of the possibility of being stopped, searched, treated like a criminal, and that's normal, both from a community perspective and it's treated as normal from a policing perspective. And it is shocking to my students who come from a different reality, like, whoa, that would never be countenanced in the communities in which they live. And what that means in the Constitution, to stop or to search someone, so I'll say this as a law professor, what that means is that you have to have reasonable suspicion that that person has committed a crime. And if you're going to search them, you're saying that you have reasonable belief that they are armed and dangerous. So every single child is getting a message here, black in Chicago, New York, L.A., that we look like armed and dangerous criminals. And that mindset needs to be fundamentally changed so that police officers see themselves not as outsiders, but as a part of the community, accountable to the community, beholden to the community, and guardians. And I talk with many folks in the neighborhoods, if they're choosing between, in their experience, what they have, and many, many folks will say, we want no police because they're not doing any good for us. And I don't think that's fair either. When you have folks who don't have a, it's the paradox of too much and too little at the same time of, we hear story after story of police not being there responding appropriately when needed, and then the story of too much when they're abusive and treating people disrespectfully. Why not give people in public housing communities and other black and brown communities around the same thing that many folks in white middle class communities get, want, and ask, which are basically police who are going to be respectful of the basic dignity of every person, and police officers who are a part of and who are there and who are supposed to be there to provide protection and to be of guarding. So it really requires a change of mindset. And positively, I've seen some of those things happen in other places. I used to live in the Bay Area in California. I used to live for a short time in Oakland and neighboring city, Richmond, California. And when I was there, Richmond's predominantly minority community, predominantly low income. There was a terrible relationship between police and community. And I saw what a change of mindset could do there. There was a new police chief who came in, and his name is Chris Magnus, who has done some incredible things in terms of trying to change the mindset of the officers there. It's paid dividends. He's created real accountability, and we're seeing not just crime at all-time lows in Richmond, California, but police shootings at all-time lows and uses of force at all-time lows. And because officers are now seeing themselves and being evaluated by resolving conflict, resolving situations without the need for arrest, that's how they get points, by getting out of their cars and engaging folks in positive relationships, by being involved and working in neighborhoods for sustained amounts of time, being accountable to folks in that community, building trust, that's how they get credit. And it's a change of mindset, and it can make a difference.
Well, we want to thank you for sharing your thoughts with us, and most strategically, some of the work that you have been doing, the very important work which we can look to in our cities, such as New Jersey, Connecticut, and New York. How can people find out more about your actual project?
I'm easy to find on the University of Chicago Law School's website, and there is a webpage that you can click on for me and my project and see what we're up to. And that's where I go. If you simply Google my name, University of Chicago, really easy to find.
Well, Professor Craig Futterman, Clinical Professor of Law and Director of the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Project, and who's done this important critical study, Citizens Police Data Project, talking about accountability, transparency, and putting control in the hands of the community for the vile and abusive processes that have ensued, lo, these many years in Chicago amongst the policing apparatus. We thank you so much for joining us, and of course, keep up the good work, and we'll learn from it.
I'm so grateful for you having me. Thanks so much.
Our pleasure. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.